You'll hear a little bit about my background, actually, in this talk, for those of you who are not and who I don't know yet. So, welcome. I was in Bodh Gaya, India, which is the place that the Buddha is said to have found enlightenment, sitting under the Bodhi tree. And I was there with the Bodh Gaya Development Association, supporting the Prajna Vihara School. So this group was very much with me in my heart, because every week we have the donation box for Prajna Vihara School. And some of us put our little pennies in there and off they go, and we hope it's for some useful and worthwhile thing. So I got to go to the school and offer service and volunteer there in the mornings, which was a lot of things. It was beautiful, it was challenging, room full of 70 fourth graders who don't speak English, and the teacher not so much either, you know. But so good to see that our generosity from this group and our efforts have supported this school for 27 years now. There are 600 students at the school now, who was started by a group of meditators primarily from Brisbane in a tent in a field. And now it has this structure, and we got to meet with some of the graduates of the school who shared with us about being able to move from their from being socially consigned to their role as members of the Dalit caste, the most exploited and disadvantaged caste in India. And because of the education they're offered, you know, we met a nurse. We met people who have gone on to university in the maths and in languages so that they can work as guides locally. We met a woman who at 24 doesn't have to be married because she has this education, and now she's a teacher at Prajna Vihara School. And for these children, and especially for the girls, so powerful to see the impact on their lives of this gift of education. And to help support that and offer some education in our way, I've had a lot of ambivalence about some of our role there. I mean, everybody had the best of intentions, but I also had a real awareness of, are we galloping in to like save these poor people? So trying to be really sensitive to that. And for me, I think that came to a, it was really crystallized in teaching yoga and meditation to the, it was I think 8th or 9th graders. That was one of the things I offered. Well, I actually participated in as many of the dance classes as I could. So I offered my enthusiasm to learn Bollywood dancing. That enthusiasm is vast. I could see going on to a whole new career there. But in terms of something I actually taught or offered, it was this meditation and yoga class to 9th graders. These kids were stunning in their ability to sit down and hold their presence and hold their meditation seat for 20 or 25 minutes. I've taught meditation to Australian youth and American youth, and these kids who are primarily Muslim and Hindu, there's very few local or native Buddhists in the area anymore. So it's not like they come from families of meditation backgrounds. They also come from families that are lacking in TV and Facebook and some of these other things that can really rewire our ability to be attentive. So they were phenomenal with this meditation and so inspiring to me to see that, to see that level of presence modeled by such young people. So lots more stories from Prajnavihar School, and for those of you who have been supporting it in different ways, welcome to come ask me more afterwards. I'd be happy to share, and I'll bring in some pictures too. One of the most profound personal moments for me was meditating in the Mahabodhi temple grounds, right underneath the Bodhi tree. It's a multi-generational Bodhi tree. This is not the original Bodhi tree from 2,600 years ago, just to disabuse any of you of the same dreamy illusion I had. It's like Bodhi tree junior. But, you know, meditating on this sacred ground where so many pilgrims have come over centuries, surrounded by practitioners from every culture and with monastics from every tradition. And it's this beautiful sanctuary space. You go through security, you get patted down. It's very not so spiritually sacred feeling, getting into the temple grounds, and then you're in this sanctuary. So profound. So uncomfortable meditating there. So, like, they don't have big cushy cushions there, and I'm just sitting on this hard marble ground under the Bodhi tree, feeling really wriggly and like, oh, I just want to wipe the sweat off. It's 6 a.m. How can it be this hot? Oh my God, the Buddha must have been way more enlightened than me because I can barely like stay here. Like, it was uncomfortable, but also so rich, sensorially rich. You know, you can feel the cool marble and the hardness of the marble, and it smells cleaner than many places in the city because of all of the green, and you can feel the air. It's so hot and so humid that there's this sensory feeling from just the air. So I'm sitting and it's 6 a.m. and I hear Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa, from just many, many, many voices of these monastics beginning their morning chanting in Pali, the language that we have the teachings of the Buddha recorded in, and beginning their chanting by taking refuge in the noble and perfectly enlightened one. And it was like electric, the feeling. And so I folded my hands and chanted quietly along with them, Buddham Saranam Gacchami, Dhamma Saranam Gacchami, Sangham Saranam Gacchami. And twice more. Those of you who know it can join if you want, because the next part is Dityampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dityampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Dityampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So this is the refuge chant. This is, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, and I take refuge in the Sangha, the community. And they continued chanting many, many, many minutes, many pages if they were reading. They weren't, but, you know, many pages of chants that I don't know. But I was so moved by getting to take refuge again, because in the Buddha Dharma, taking refuge and taking the five precepts is like a doorway into the riches of the Dharma that many lay practitioners will take. Sometimes more formally, sometimes on the fly, like we just did. But it's like a beginning. It's a place where we can commit to reorient ourselves toward the riches of what the Dharma has to offer, and to turn away from some of the less skillful places that we may be habitually placing our time and our energy, and to instead incline the mind in this more wholesome way, cultivating wisdom and compassion to benefit our own selves and to benefit all beings. We may do it in a more formal sense. When I first took refuge, it was with Gil Fronstall in the San Francisco Bay Area. And we had a 6-week course, because he really wanted us to know, as new practitioners, or, you know, many of us were longtime practitioners and just taking this again, because like the rest of the Dharma, there's so much depth there. It's not like one and done. You know, there's something to be revealed with every new inquiry. So it was a 6-week series that culminated in a really special ceremony of taking refuge. We were given a scroll. Yeah, it's a very fancy scroll outlining our practice tradition, starting with the Buddha and then going through the lineage that came to Gil Fronstall and then to each of us with our name there. Yeah, I had family members come. It was a very special and beautiful event for me. So some of us will have that, and others of us may not have that kind of formal first refuge experience, but we may take refuge when we begin a retreat or when we sit with a particular teacher. We may take refuge in our daily practice as, you know, a place we begin the day by inclining ourselves and our intention into the day. And we take refuge because there's a lot of unsafety and unease in the world. We walk through our day beset by physical uncertainty, aging and sickness and death. These are unmanageable, uncertain, and they're potential grounds of discomfort and unskillful behavior. We're beset with our own minds every day. There are some dangers present there, where we can get caught in traps that keep us in suffering. In the Dhammapada, which is a sort of pithy collection of sayings from the Buddha, we find the quote, "Driven only by fear do people go for refuge to many places, to hills, woods, groves, trees, shrines. Such indeed is no safe refuge. Such is not the refuge supreme. Not by resorting to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. One who has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the teachings, and the Sangha penetrates with transcendental wisdom suffering, the cause of suffering, the sensation of suffering, and the noble path leading to the cessation of suffering. This indeed is the safe refuge. This is the refuge supreme. Having gone to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering." So we start from that place of being driven by fear, and we find this path toward refuge, which means what? Give me, throw some definitions out. What's
safety?
Safety, yeah.
Reliable, dependable.
Harm comes to mind.
Harm.
Oh,
home. Yeah. Like a refuge is a place of safety and protection. It is a home. You think of like a wildlife refuge or something. Mm-hmm. This is a habitat, a place to live from that is safe and sheltered. And in order for it to be a refuge, it needs to be safe in a really profound way. It needs to be free from falling victim to the vicissitudes of all these different kinds of suffering and danger. It needs to be somewhere utterly free from that and protected and sheltered from those kinds of stresses and dangers. It also needs to be somewhere accessible to us. A refuge that we can't actually get to isn't that much of a safe spot at all. And so this tradition of taking refuge that's woven through the Buddhist path and mentioned in the suttas, it's not some Johnny-come-lately, it's this ancient practice. And there's the promise within it that it does provide sure ground and safety, and that it is somewhere accessible that we can get to. So the classic formulation is to take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. These three are interconnected. You can't just choose one. Sometimes we do. You know, sometimes it may be that there's one aspect of that that feels really alive for us and that we're going to really delve into within our practice. But another term for taking refuge is taking refuge in the triple gem. It's seen as being this gem with many facets. It's one thing, but there's these different facets and windows we can get in on it with. So we need all three of them, and we can explore them on so many different levels. Each of them has this surface level understanding. They take refuge in the Buddha. Within Buddhism, this doesn't mean we're praying for divine intercession from the Buddha. It means that we're looking to this historical person as a guide and as an inspiration for someone who found a way free from being ensnared by suffering. So it's, you know, this surface level of the actual person, and it's also this deeper understanding of our own capacity of movement toward increasing wisdom and compassion. It's our own capacity to awaken and become free from suffering. So this is the Buddha. It may also mean teachers, you know, sort of generally looking to who are these people who are ahead of us on the path who offer us guidance and inspiration. So, you know, there's all these levels. Looking at refuge in the Dhamma, at one level, this just means the map. It's the path and the practice, the teachings that the Buddha outlined for us. And it's a mighty good place to start, right? Sometimes I just need to be told what to do like many, 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 many times over before I have an inkling of understanding, like, oh, maybe that would be a good thing to try. Let me try that. So we have the Dharma giving us a really clear path to freedom, and we can pick up pieces or take steps on that path and find out whether that works for us or not. We can also think of the refuge in the Dhamma as being a place where we begin to cultivate our own capacity to stay present in this moment, in this often uncomfortable or uneasy or just tedious moment. You know, taking refuge in the Dharma is taking refuge in the truth. And that means the truth of what's present right now without my habitual ways of trying to lock it down, manage it, and keep everything under control. Keep my defenses up so I can control the outcome getting there rather than really showing up for a kind of quaky feeling that is so alive in so many moments. So these layers.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Well, it's more of an observation on my part, and I wonder what you would think as well. Often I thought it was synonymous with trust in, like it feels like it's, when I'm taking refuge, I never really thought about it as a place or a refuge, as we would usually use the word. It was more like a relaxation into trust.
Mm.
Is that an aspect of it? I misinterpreted something?
I think that's really beautiful. That works for me. I think what comes up for me when I hear you talk about refuge as a place of trust is that for many of us, there's a devotional aspect to it. There's an emotional aspect to this practice of taking refuge, which is neither, you know, doing that chant, it's neither a place nor is it an attitude of trust, right? It's just some words that we might chant, but they're imbued with all of these different levels of meaning and with our own commitment, including trust that this actually works and that we've discerned this is a wise place to put, or a wise direction to place our efforts and our commitment. So, yeah.
Yeah, because it feels like lay all my skepticism aside. That's what it feels like. And all the questions, the skepticism, the doubts. So it feels like to be like laid in the way and trust in.
Yeah.
I didn't know whether I had the right idea.
Yeah. I think that's fine. I think there's so many ways to work with it. That's what offers richness in that practice of taking refuge over time. You know, all these different levels and layers that will feel resonant at different times. And not all of them are wise view, but that sure sounds like it is. And so then there's this refuge we take in the Sangha, in the community, right? In our ability to have these kinds of conversations with like-minded people who are equally devoted to their path of awakening and transformation. Traditionally, taking refuge in the Sangha referred perhaps to the monastic Sangha, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, although we also find in the suttas a commitment to a fourfold Sangha, which includes laymen and laywomen who are committed on this path. So I take refuge in Sangha means, you know, this community of supportive spiritual friends and teachers. I think that more profoundly, taking refuge in Sangha means committing ourselves to radically questioning the ways that we hold on to our sense of separation and our sense of individuality, and being able to come to a place of engaging with our interconnection with all beings in a way that is both it's a gift that is given and received in all directions. One of the ways we do this at the surface level is by taking the five precepts often in the traditional structure. We would do the refuge chant and then we would take the five precepts of committing ourselves to refrain from harm, to cultivate compassion, to refrain from theft and to cultivate generosity, to refrain from sexual misconduct and to cultivate lively health in our bodies, and to refrain from harmful speech and to cultivate wise, kind speech, and to refrain from taking intoxicants in harmful ways and to cultivate clarity and lucidity. So it's built in with this classical structure, this piece of taking the precepts and offering that gift to our community, both our smaller community and our larger community, of the gift of restraint from unharmful acts. So we do that on the physical level, but again, you know, coming to a place of being able to really viscerally sense the unity of all beings, and that I am not different from the ones that I love, nor the ones that I don't love so much. We're all in this together, and so finding a place to experience refuge within that interconnection and to offer refuge within that interconnection. I add my own refuges sometimes when I'm feeling moved to do so. It may be spending some time contemplating, taking refuge in emptiness, the unconditioned, an ability to show up with a sense of open potential for every fresh new moment. It may be refuge in nature or art, you know, all these other different ways that can support me. I also take refuge in unskillful things. Sometimes we call this false refuge. In this group, I think many of us have let go of some of these unreliable sources of thinking we can manage our discomfort through getting super loaded and following our sex addiction and our, video game addiction. Like, many of us have let go of some of those really obvious places of false refuge, but we may also continue to struggle with different kinds of defendedness, with a social media habit that lets us not stay present because we can just zone out on Facebook for a while. Shopping, even things that seem healthy, like exercise and eating so much salad that I actually make my tummy hurt. This can be a place of false refuge when I'm using it as an identity to manage discomfort, to manage the unreliability of my physical experience. If I eat enough salad and run enough, maybe I will be forever young and never die, right? And not only that, but maybe you will perceive me as being really healthy. And, you know, I can hold on to that identity as a false refuge. So looking for ways to release that hold and be able to show up, just one amongst all of us, you know, with all of our places of challenge, but also this beautiful path that gives us some shelter and some refuge. There's a simile in the suttas that the Buddha is like a rain cloud moving over a parched, dry, drought-stricken land. And the Dharma is like the rain falling, these teachings, this path that's given to us is rain falling onto the dry land. And the Sangha is all of the creatures and all of the plants that are revivified in the rain, and they spring back to life and back to vitality. And something I love about this is that this simile is that once these plants are nourished and revitalized, it's not like a selfish deal like, yo, I got mine, I'm all good. The plants and the trees are giving back then. They're participating in the carbon dioxide and oxygen cycle. They're purifying the toxins out of our air. They're creating beauty for our eye. Like, they're giving back. And I think that refuge has to do that too. When I first took refuge, I didn't see that piece of it. I just saw, oh, I've found something that can help me have less suffering. Cool. I'm in. I'm doing it. But to come to see that a refuge I go into by myself is no refuge at all, and that I want my practice to offer shelter and sanctuary to the others around me has been a place I've grown. I would argue that I've grown. Maybe some others might not. I don't know. Seems like growth to me.
Seems like it now.
Yeah, it sounded good, right? So I'm going to end with another Sutta quote. Practitioners, be islands unto yourselves. Be your own refuge. Have no other. Let the Dhamma be an island and a refuge to you. Have no other. Those who are islands to themselves should investigate to the very heart of things. Pinnatadipasutta. So that's it. That's my reflections on refuge tonight. Thank you for your attention. And we are going to do